Today, escalating tensions in Myanmar over a week on from a coup that put Aung San Suu Kyi back under house arrest.
So I woke up at 8 a.m. that morning, and I immediately saw a message that said that there has been a coup going on in the country and that our leaders have been arrested.
The voice you can hear belongs to a journalist in Myanmar. We're not naming her to protect her identity.
And my phone lines have been cut. Our internet has been disrupted, and our news channels were also unavailable. Except for the military-run Myawadi channel. My initial reaction was shock, and my parents were very stoic about this because they have already been through this. The first thing that I did was to run to the bank and drain my bank account. I was very lucky because a few hours after that, all banks announced that they were closed. And people were now panicking. And a lot of people's response is that the thing that they have been fearing the most has come true.
For many people in Myanmar, this fear of being plunged into a military dictatorship has now turned to anger. Tens of thousands are demonstrating in cities across the country this week in the largest protests that have been seen there for over a decade. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, how a military coup led to a fight for democracy in Myanmar. Rebecca Ratcliffe, you're The Guardian's Southeast Asia correspondent and you're in Bangkok. And I think a lot of people's entry to this story came last week when a bizarre video circulated online from Myanmar of a woman doing an aerobics routine as a coup began happening behind her. What was really going on?
Well, it all started in the early hours of Monday morning when the military in Myanmar began detaining government leaders, including Aung San Suu Kyi, who is the de facto leader of the country. It became clear as the morning went on that there was a coup. And this was officially announced on military TV at 8 a.m. The woman in that video, it seems she didn't realise that the coup was actually going on behind her and there were vehicles driving towards Parliament. I mean, it shocked people when they woke up on Monday morning, but it didn't come as a complete surprise.
Why did the military say they were doing this?
So the military has sort of justified taking control of the country because they have accused the National League for Democracy, which is Aung San Suu Kyi's party, of terrible fraud in the most recent elections, which took place in November.
Scores of National League for Democracy supporters celebrate the party's victory in national elections.
The NLD won the elections with a huge mandate.
NLD is winning, especially in Yangon, by a big margin.
It's an even bigger mandate than in the historic 2015 elections, which were the first sort of free elections to be held in the country in decades.
In order to perform scrutiny on the voter lists and take actions, the authority of the nation's lawmaking, governance and jurisdiction is handed over to the commander-in-chief.
And the election process wasn't flawless, but all observers dismiss this claim. They haven't provided evidence to substantiate this.
Let's start with the military coup in Myanmar. Police have filed several charges against the elected leader Aung San Suu Kyi. The charges she faces are unexpected, related to 7 walkie-talkies used by her security guards.
And in another bizarre twist, Aung San Suu Kyi has been charged with possession of illegally imported walkie-talkies, according to the military. What does this really mean?
Yes, so she's been charged under the Import-Export Act, and she's accused of illegally importing walkie-talkies and using them without permission. It's quite clear that these are politically motivated charges. It's obviously sort of ridiculous that she's been charged for having walkie-talkies. You know, she's a head of state. But it could lead to her having to serve 2 years in prison, and it could also prevent her from running in future elections.
Who is in charge now?
The commander-in-chief of the army, Min Aung Hlaing, has taken control of the country for 1 year, apparently. He is the man who was in charge of the army when it carried out its brutal crackdown on Rohingya Muslims. The UN has said that that campaign was carried out with genocidal intent.
Predictably, the internet was shut down when the coup began. How long did that last for?
Well, it's been sort of on and off, patchy at all times, and phone lines have been patchy. I mean, on Thursday, Facebook, which is people's main method of communication, that was blocked by the military. Essentially, it was being used by people to organise a civil disobedience movement in response to the coup. Then Twitter was banned on Friday, Instagram was banned, and then on Saturday, they introduced a nationwide sort of internet shutdown, and I think connectivity went to like 16% of its normal levels. And that lasted about 24 hours, but that has created a lot of confusion and panic. It means that people aren't able to contact their loved ones. And of course, there's real concern that the military, which has an appalling record for human rights, was shutting out the world, basically, and that media and human rights groups were struggling to monitor of what was happening.
We heard earlier from a journalist in Myanmar that she was shocked by all of this. What did people you spoke to tell you about how they were feeling about the coup hours after it happened?
There was a real sense of shock. It's brought back the bleak memories of the many decades that Myanmar was under military rule. And there's so much at stake for Myanmar at the moment. They're in the middle of a pandemic. There's an economic crisis caused by COVID. People feel like they've had democracy stolen from them, and the hopes for their country, the hope that their country would have a brighter future, they feel that that's been stolen overnight.
Myanmar then is back under military rule after a period of relative democracy for the last decade. What was life like in the country when the army was in charge?
26 years of hardline socialist rule has left Burma economically ruined with no effective political opposition.
When you ask people about that time, they describe living in fear. There was massive censorship, a lack of freedom of expression, even something like listening to the BBC, people were doing secret. There was like constant fear of being watched by spies, military spies, and there was awful persecution of minorities in the country. And yeah, when people came out on the streets and protested against military rule, those demonstrations were put down brutally.
After 5 days of violent anti-government demonstrations, which has left at least 1,000 people dead, without radical reform and a swift return to democracy, the new president will be powerless to prevent civil war.
And into this came Aung San Suu Kyi. How did she emerge in this period as the leader of the main opposition party, the National League for Democracy?
So she's the daughter of a man who is an independence hero.
From Burmese General Yu Aung San, head of his country's delegation.
Seen as the father of the nation.
My colleagues and I have come to London in order to discuss the constitutional questions of Burma.
Burma's future may be in this man's hands.
And her mother was a diplomat. And as a student, she went to the UK and she studied at Oxford University and met her husband there. But she went back to Myanmar in 1988, which was a time of a lot of political upheaval. And she emerged as someone who was leading the pro-democracy uprisings at that time. And she went on to form the NLD. She was in and out of house arrest under military rule because of her campaigning, and she spent in total about 15 years in detention. And during that time, her husband died in the UK and she wasn't able to see him because she was worried about leaving the country and not being able to get back in again. That led to her being widely seen around the world as someone who was a sort of beacon for human rights.
The Nobel Peace Prize laureate 1991, Aung San Suu Kyi.
She won the Nobel Peace Prize.
I would like to say how happy I am to receive President Obama in my country and in my house.
And she was praised by everyone from, you know, Obama to world leaders all around the world.
I'm proud to be the first American president to visit this spectacular country, and I am very pleased that one of my first stops is to visit with an icon of democracy who's inspired so many people, not just in this country, but all around the world.
Then in 2011, the military in Myanmar decided to allow for a civilian government. Why did they do that?
So they agreed to share power, but only under a constitution, which meant that they still retained lots of controls of key ministries, and they're guaranteed 25% of parliamentary seats. And the NLD has tried to reform the constitution, but they can't do so because the number of seats that the military has kind of effectively gives them a veto. One of the reasons why they did this was because the country at this point was isolated from the world, and the economy was in dire situation, and this was a way for them to open up the economy and benefit from that, but also retain a firm grip on power.
Aung San Suu Kyi was also released from house arrest. How significant was that moment in Myanmar?
It was a huge turning point in Myanmar's history because of everything that she represents. She represents, the opposite of military rule. She represents freedom. And it was a moment of hope.
How did she go on to become leader of Myanmar a few years later?
Myanmar had its first free elections in decades in 2015, and the National League for Democracy won the election with a huge mandate. But it wasn't straightforward for her to become leader of the country because the constitution had been written in a way that someone who had children, children who were foreign nationals, couldn't be president. And so she became state councillor. But she's still sort of seen as the de facto leader of the country, and the NLD's popularity is driven by her status.
But how much power then did that mean that she and the NLD actually had after winning those elections?
There were real limits on their power. I mean, some of the things that she'd promised to do, like ensure a peace process and ensure reconciliation and bring to an end the conflict in parts of the country. She promised socioeconomic reforms, but she hasn't really been able to do those things. And a big factor in that, although not the only reason, is the enduring power of the military.
But in spite of those restrictions, did life change for people in Myanmar under Aung San Suu Kyi?
As the country has opened up, there have been massive changes to people's lives. And some of the things people mention are things like electricity is no longer on a rotary system for a few hours a day. It's possible to own a mobile phone, and there have been improvements to infrastructure. And today, according to the World Bank, the proportion of the population living under the national poverty line has halved from about 50% in 2005 to a quarter of the population in 2017. But when Aung San Suu Kyi came to power, there was real hope that she would bring change. Also that as a former political prisoner, that she would reform some of the repressive laws that were used to target people politically. And that hasn't happened. And under her government, there was continued targeting of journalists and activists, and also the persecution of minorities, including Rohingya. But what lot of analysts would say is that for all those flaws, it was a more democratic government than any other in Myanmar for decades and decades. There was some space for expression, and the hope was that that would increase. And it was a fragile democracy, it was still developing, but now that process has just been completely halted.
The event, though, that has marked Aung San Suu Kyi's leadership above all else began in 2017 when the military began a brutal crackdown on Rohingya Muslims across the country. What was her role in this?
The figures paint a gruesome picture. Violence broke out in Rakhine State on the 25th of August.
In August 2017, Rohingya militants attacked security forces in Rakhine State, and that prompted this huge military crackdown.
In the month following, Doctors Without Borders says that at least 9,000 Rohingyas died, including more than 700 children under the age of five.
Which involved burning down villages, mass killings, gang rape.
The world's fastest growing humanitarian crisis as thousands of Rohingya refugees are spending a fourth night stranded near the border with Bangladesh.
700,000 people fled over the border to Bangladesh. And when this crackdown was happening, people around the world looked to her and expected her to speak out.
I don't think it has come through to her the full extent, the horror of what has happened.
But she didn't.
We want to find out why this exodus is happening.
She initially dismissed the reports of the atrocities. She blamed terrorists for creating a huge iceberg of misinformation.
The 17 judges of the International Court of Justice unanimously concluded that Myanmar's Rohingya community is at serious risk of genocide.
She eventually travelled to The Hague, where there was a genocide case, and defended the country's military against allegations of genocide.
Can there be genocidal intent on the part of the state that actively investigates, prosecutes, and punishes soldiers and officers who are accused of wrongdoing?
She maintains that the atrocities against Rohingya have been exaggerated.
I can assure you.
And in her speech at The Hague, she didn't use the word Rohingya, basically refusing to acknowledge them as a distinct ethnic group. And while her response to this crisis has destroyed her reputation internationally, but domestically it actually boosted her popularity because she was seen as being the mother of the nation, going abroad and defending the country against unfair criticism.
What does the Rohingya crisis tell us about the relationship between Aung San Suu Kyi's government and the military and military leaders like Min Aung Hlaing?
I think it's a complicated relationship and a complicated power dynamic. And on the one hand, you could argue that she wasn't in a position to do anything. And then on the other hand, you could say that maybe she thought it was politically advantageous for her to go to The Hague and defend the country. And that would play to a public who felt that the international criticism was unfair just at the time when she was about to enter an election campaign. Well, maybe she herself doesn't have very much sympathy for Rohingya.
Coming up, how long can pro-democracy protests continue in Myanmar in the face of a violent police crackdown? The army say they have staged this coup because, according to them, elections in November were rigged. But why do you think they've acted now?
So it's been a tense and uneasy relationship for a very long time. And there are lots of grievances that people within the military have over things like the economy or the peace process and the way that the NLD has handled those issues. And the reason why it's happening now, some people have speculated that the commander-in-chief is due to retire soon, and he has made no secret of the fact that he would like to be president one day. And, you know, clearly that wasn't going to happen via the November election. But there's also, analysts say, a sort of wider context where the military just aren't happy with sharing power.
Over a week on from the coup, how have people responded to what has happened? You've been speaking to the journalist that we heard at the start of this episode, what has she and others told you?
There's a real sense of shock and also of fear.
A lot of people who had NLD signs in their profile picture on social media removed it immediately. A lot of people took down NLD flags from their houses.
And there was lots of confusion and misinformation, especially when communications were restricted. A message that appeared on an NLD Facebook page that was attributed to Aung San Suu Kyi called for people to protest. And people weren't sure if this was genuine and if the NLD had control of the Facebook page or if it was a trap.
A lot of people have been using this opportunity to spread misinformation. The military started sharing false news that Aung San Suu Kyi was released. Thousands of people, including my family, ran onto the streets to celebrate, only to realize that the news wasn't true. It was extremely disheartening, and many are calling this psychological warfare.
So the response wasn't immediate. The first thing that people did is that they went and withdrew money and stocked up on food.
Yeah. Can we go out onto your balcony?
But then gradually as the week went on, there were signs of protest.
Can you hear that?
On Tuesday night, people started banging pots and pans on their balcony at 8 p.m. as a sort of symbolic protest.
By banging the pots, people are trying to scare away the evil that is invading our home, Myanmar.
Then on Wednesday, medics announced that they would launch a civil disobedience campaign and that they wouldn't go to work in state hospitals. They were still treating patients, but they were treating them in their homes or at charity clinics. And the medics who were still going to work were wearing red ribbons to show their support for Aung San Suu Kyi, because that's the colour that's associated with the NLD.
Civil disobedience movements have grown in size and number, more emerging every day since healthcare workers were the first to come out earlier in the week by going on strike.
But gradually as the week went on, more and more people joined teachers and engineers. And then at the weekend,
this is the biggest protest in Myanmar since 2007. Tens of thousands of people on the streets of Yangon.
There were significant protests. There was the first mass protest on Saturday, and this grew even larger on Sunday. I wondered if you had a sense of whether the mood has changed as the week has gone on.
Yes, there has been a lot of unity, I think, a lot of strength that people get from seeing other protesters on the streets. A lot of people have joined the protest, singing songs, making chants, and most people sang the pro-democracy song Kaba Majebu, which means the world is not at peace.
It's people of all generations who are taking to the street. But something that the journalist who's based in Yangon told me is that the experience is quite different for people who are older.
So most of the older generations that I have interviewed are extremely concerned about the future of the next generation. And they fear bloodshed. They fear that their grandchildren will be killed, just as many friends and family have been during the 1988 uprising. They are afraid of the chaos. They are afraid of living in fear and having to do things secretly. There is definitely still a very big risk that the military will respond with violence to the protests.
These protests have continued into this week. How have the police and the military responded to them?
The military has imposed a curfew and also a ban on gatherings of five or more people. But despite this, and also despite the increasing use of force by the authorities, we're seeing water cannon, rubber bullets, tear gas, and live ammunition being fired into the air at one point.
But that hasn't stopped people across the country demanding democracy be restored.
People have still taken to the streets, and these protests are being held right across the country. I spoke to a reporter in Yangon earlier, And he described there being a sort of festival, almost celebratory atmosphere in downtown Yangon. He said, like, little shops are playing loud revolutionary songs, drivers are offering free rides to demonstrators, volunteers are handing out energy drinks and boiled eggs. And across the country, there's actually dozens of police officers have sort of defected and have joined the sides of the protesters. But undercutting this kind of atmosphere of people power and this almost festival atmosphere, there is a sense of dread and anxiety. The police are becoming tougher in their use of force, and there is fears about this increasing. And tragically, one example of this is that one woman was actually hit in the head. The details of this remain slightly unclear as of Wednesday afternoon, but Reuters reported that they spoke to a medic who was treating her, that she was in critical condition, and one of the doctors treating her said that according to an x-ray, it was a live bullet that hit her.
Aung San Suu Kyi has been under house arrest since last Monday, and as we record this on Wednesday, no one has heard from her. What has been the response from the international community to all of this?
So the coup was widely condemned by lots of countries around the world, including the US. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has called for all detainees to be released. And the Security Council put out a statement which expressed grave concern, but a draft copy suggested that it appeared to have been watered down. And in the past, it's China and Russia, who are both members of the Security Council that have veto powers, have shielded Myanmar's military from criticism.
Do you think that a sort of international involvement could make a difference to what's happening in Myanmar?
So the US has threatened sanctions.
US President Joe Biden issued a stern warning to the country's military leaders: reverse course or face economic sanctions.
But what a lot of analysts have warned is that any sanctions do need to be targeted so that they hit the military generals and that they don't just add to the suffering of the general population, which has been the case in the past.
Finally, Rebecca, does this signal the end of democracy in Myanmar?
This is a hugely significant moment. It was only 10 years ago that the country began transitioning towards a more democratic system after spending 50 years under military rule. And people are really worried about their futures, about the economy and about their livelihoods. They're worried about their children going out to protest and then there being a violent clampdown. People feel that the future of their country is at stake and they will continue coming out to protest. We'll have to see if they can sustain that, but certainly people are really, really angry and really determined that they shouldn't have democracy taken away from them in this way.
Given that there are risks in protesting, why are people still taking to the streets? Like, what is at stake for Myanmar?
Most of our generation have lived through military control, so we understand the fear, the tension. And after living through 10 years of democracy, I think that most people do not want to go back. And I think that their anger and this desperation far overpowers the fear they have for violence. And I think a lot of people are going to join the protests tomorrow and the day after that.
You can read more of Rebecca Ratcliffe's reporting on the coup in Myanmar, along with coverage of the protests from journalists in the country and from our international correspondent, Michael Safi, at theguardian.com. Thanks to Rebecca and to the journalist in Myanmar for speaking to us for this episode. It was produced by Rose Delarabiti and Ree Storer. Sound design was by Axel Kakutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.